number 03-2422, by David Irving against the City of Elkhart, Indiana.
Good morning. I'm Douglas Grimes for the appellant, Mr. Irving. The position of the appellant in this case is that in situations where a supervisor directs or orders the employee to violate the policies, rules, and regulations of the employer, our position is that that constitutes an adverse employment action. And we say that because what it does, when that occurs, we are dealing with the core relationship between the employer and the employee. The employee has been hired on and has agreed to follow the rules and regulations of the employer. Our position is that in this particular case, the order by the supervisor to violate the rules and regulations of the employer amounted to discriminatory changes in the terms and conditions of Irving's employment based on race. Our position is that the order placed or exposed Irving to disadvantageous terms and conditions of employment to which employees outside of the protected class were not exposed.
But this is a summary judgment, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What evidence in the record was there that the supervisor never tried to be a good Samaritan with anyone else other than an African-American employee?
Well, first of all, the instructions, the supervisor never gave these instructions to anyone else.
Well, those instructions, but what the supervisor said was he was asking this man to go outside the scope of the authorized employment on that day, and what we don't know is whether he had ever, in the history of time, ever asked any other employee to go outside the scope of authorized employment, maybe not driving a forklift, maybe doing something else, you know, delivering a letter, I mean, anything. But there's no evidence fundamentally. I mean, so in a sense, you're making two arguments. You're saying it's an adverse employment action. The district court finds it just hasn't ripened into any such thing yet, and you're secondly saying that there's something about discrimination, but the record doesn't appear to support that.
Well, I believe that the record does support the fact that the supervisor testified in his deposition that he had never asked or given instructions to an employee to violate the policies of the employer. In addition, there is testimony that no other employee that was an employee of the city had ever been asked to violate the rules of the employer. In this particular case...
But how can we then draw an inference of race discrimination from that? The first one asked in the... has to be something. Race discrimination can happen against whites, it can happen against African Americans, it can happen against anybody. How do we know? What is there that would permit an inference of that? Again, putting to one side this perhaps more fundamental issue about the fact that nothing has happened to him.
Well, I think that one of the things that we consider is the fact that Irving was the only African American under this supervisor's supervision.
Yeah.
He was the only one in the department.
And he was the only one there that day, too. But Well, I actually wish that you would talk, too, about the fact that this incident happened, and then that's it. I mean, the supervisor could have made a mistake thinking that it was okay to help out the people. How is something that never ripens into a disciplinary consequence, a job assignment consequence, money, anything? How can that be an adverse employment action?
Well, I think, or our position is, that it is when a supervisor instructs an employee to violate the company rules.
Right, so something is there in the file that if anybody ever tried to do anything to him about it, he would be able to explain, I did this on my supervisor's instructions.
That's not where I'm headed, Judge.
Well,
my
that's
position,
where I'm headed.
Okay,
tonight.
Well, I'm trying to accommodate, when I say that, I'm trying to accommodate your concern, and that is that our view is that an employee, a supervisor, when they order, when a supervisor orders an employee to violate his employment contract, that itself is an adverse employment action. In this particular case,
why?
Because it alters the terms and conditions of its employment.
That's just a phrase. Why is it an adverse action if you do what your supervisor said? And you don't go out and shoot somebody. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't situations where you would be quite entitled to be insubordinate. But going and down, I mean, I just don't see why it's suddenly so adverse.
Well, we believe it's adverse because it impacts and changes and alters the basic terms of the employment.
How much time did he spend on this detour?
About a half hour, 40 minutes.
The city of Elkhart may have thought it was de minimis if they ever heard about it, shouldn't they?
Well, they did. Well, they heard about this particular incident.
I mean, you're saying it's a violation of the policy. Couldn't the city just regard it as de minimis? Doesn't amount to enough to worry
about?
Well,
apparently they did. Apparently that's how they regarded it.
Well, then why is it a violation of anything if they regard it as de minimis?
Well, I think that the problem is goes to the core relationship between the employer and the employee. What are the expectations of an employee? Does he take a job and expect that he is going to be ordered by a supervisor who didn't have the authority in the first place to order him to do that? Is he now subject to the supervisor saying, go down and get me a hamburger or go and collect my laundry? My point is this, that my view is that it affects the basic relationship between the employer and the employee, given the power dynamic that exists between the employer and the employee. Well, how far do we take this? I believe that it's the kind of situation that should not go unrecognized by the law in this circuit. Because what then would be the limit?
But Judge, I think you're going under the wrong theory, though. I'm sure there are statutes in Indiana, and for all I know, in the city of Elkhart, there may be policies that forbid using employees for non-job related functions, you know, whether it's ghost payrolling or whether it's diversion to private efforts. Title VII in 1983 are federal statutes, Title VII focusing on discrimination, of which I see very little in this record. 1983 is something quite different. Every violation of state law is not a violation of 1983.
I would agree with
and
that.
And so, you know, what he does is he complains to the people who are above the supervisor. He brings it to somebody's attention. He should be protected against anti-retaliation. He should be protected by anti-retaliation statutes. If he's constantly being told, go make coffee or go get me a sandwich or go pick up my dry cleaning, there are plenty of laws that we've seen that address that.
My time is up, but I've reserved.
No, you're
up.
Under your rebuttal. But anyway.
Yeah, but the other issue is that this kind of abuse of the employer-employee relationship, I believe, violates the public policy established by Title VII. I don't think that it's totally unrelated to Title VII, nor that it's not something that should be recognized in the case law.
You're not pursuing your First Amendment claim on appeal, is that right?
No.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to address first Your Honor's question regarding the evidence of any illegal motivation. There simply isn't any. We raised it in the district court. We raised two bases in the district court for summary judgment. One was the absence of any adverse job action. The second was the inability of the plaintiff to establish race discrimination or any illegal motivation, whether it was retaliation or not. That argument was not addressed in the plaintiff's opening brief. It was addressed in our answering memorandum, pointing out that we are seeking to affirm the court's ruling on an alternative basis not advanced by the district court. No reply brief has been filed in this court addressing that argument. the sufficiency or insufficiency of the evidence regarding illegal motivation, whether it's race or retaliation, is no longer an issue before this court. So this court can affirm Judge Miller's ruling simply based upon waiver. As far as this being de minimis, I think we have to look at least the underlying facts as to how this had arisen. I mean, the unrebutted testimony is that this order, if you call it an order, was given by his supervisor. Go help the guy out next door. The undisputed evidence is that Anderson hadn't even thought of the company policy or the city policy at the time he gave this order. The thought never crossed his mind that he was in any way compelling an employee to violate company policy. The city, it was so de minimis, the city didn't even learn about this until the Title VII charge was filed. And that's when we first looked into the matter and said, what is going on here? Call the Anderson in, he explains the situation, he gets some counseling. That's what this case is about, an insignificant issue that nobody even considered as being a violation of policy, a violation of city policy. The plaintiff's counsel says, given the power of the master-servant relationship and the dynamics, I mean, if that power existed and if it was going to be exerted in this case, we would see something else other than simply this possibility that something may come of this incident that occurred 3 years ago or 4 years ago that we never knew anything about. There would be some evidence that this incident somehow had some adverse impact on career opportunities. There would be some evidence that it made his working conditions unbearable. There would be some evidence that something happened to him. Title VII says there has to be an alteration of the terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. Material adverse employment action is not found in the text of E2, but it's been read into it by the courts. It's been read into it in the context of hostile environment claims. There's got to be something significant going on and significant happening to you. We use Justice Posner in the Heinreicher case that plaintiff's counsel paraphrases or cites in his brief. Said, you know, there's a lot of different adjectives that the courts have used in describing what has to happen to you. It has to be either tangible, is what some cases talk about. It has to be significant, some cases talk about. Other cases talk about material adverse effect. That simply is not here in the case before your honors.
The only thing that happened here was Anderson was counseled. Is that
the only thing that happened is that the defendant in this case was counseled, correct. When this issue was brought to our attention through the filing of the EEOC charge, in which the plaintiff said for the first time to anyone, it was to the EEOC that I've been the victim of discrimination and retaliation because I was ordered to help out a contractor who was putting an HVAC unit in a McDonald's. That's when we first learned about anything in this case. What we have, Your Honor, is the classic proposition that's been repeatedly rejected by this court. Not everything that makes an employee unhappy is actionable. The court has repeatedly stated, not every act of invidious discrimination, and I submit there's no evidence of invidious discrimination, but not every act of invidious discrimination is forbidden by Title VII. Plaintiff's counsel, I've tried to pigeonhole this case into something. He says he was ordered to violate a policy. Employees under the case law in this circuit who have been cited in written reprimands for violating public policy, that's not sufficient to be an actionable Title VII action. That you have to show something more than something sitting in an employee's file. Written reprimands, which is a statement that you have violated my policy, a statement from the employer, isn't enough unless you can show that there are some negative consequences, unless you can show that career opportunities have been foreclosed as a result of the written reprimand. Unless you can show that if there's been some negative evaluation, even though racially motivated, career opportunities have been foreclosed. It's simply not there. We don't even have a threat. Your Honor mentioned the sword of Damocles. That's not even around in this case. There is no sword hanging over this guy's head.
Is there anything in this fellow's file?
Probably what's in the file is that he filed a Title VII claim against us. That's the first thing that hit the file, Judge. We've cited to Your Honor the closest thing that I could find, the Ayayi case versus Aramark. It was a 2003 decision of the circuit. And the court said an employee was threatened to be demoted. The court said a threat to demote somebody until it comes to, until it happens, is not adverse job action. We don't even have the threat here. I see my time is about up. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Grimes, you have a minute left.
I want to emphasize, we're not talking about a threat. We're not talking about something that may happen later. We're talking about something that actually happened. And when he was given that order to violate the rules and regulations of his employer by his supervisor, to whom he could not resist, otherwise would have been found as having been insubordinate, that was the time when the adverse action occurred. From that point on, the employer-employee relationship had been altered by now my client having to make a decision as to whether he is going to follow the rules of his employer or he's going to follow the direction of his supervisor that contravenes the rules of his employer and does that as a result of an order by his employer. So no, it's not a threat. It did in fact occur, and it occurred at the time that he was given the order to contravene the authority of his employer and to violate their rules. Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken.